That tax compromise is making its way through Congress.
And we're spending more at stores. But why?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, the 14th of December. Coming up, what's behind the positive news on retail sales? And when Christmas and Hanukkah prove too much for a prison inmate's tummy, he pulls out the old let's make up a holiday gag.
But first, a final Senate vote could come as early as today for the president's $800 billion tax cut compromise. That's after it passed in an 83-15 preliminary vote yesterday. Then the bill is off to the House, where if it passes there, taxpayers will see a couple of changes in their paychecks. Robert N. Williams is with the Tax Policy Center.
One, the Making Work Pay Credit will disappear, but it'll be replaced with a one-year reduction in the payroll taxes that fund Social Security. Now, the payroll tax reduction will increase people's take-home pay. Most people will see the larger paycheck every paycheck during the year.
The tax cut compromise also extends a benefit to commuters that was part of last year's stimulus. It's meant to give transit riders the same write-offs as people who park their car at work. Marketplace's David Gurra reports.
The tax break gave commuters a new incentive to use mass transit. They could deduct up to $230 per month for bus rides, train fare, and van pools. Jay Winters is with the Center for Urban Transportation Research. He says studies have shown this kind of benefit does change how people behave.
There was an increase in transit ridership. In some cases, transit ridership more than doubled.
And that kind of growth can be even more valuable than building new infrastructure that doesn't create jobs right away. Rachel Weinberger is a professor at Penn.
Anytime you spend money on transit, that's money that stays in the local economy.
She says increased demand means bus drivers and maintenance workers keep their jobs, and they usually spend their money where they live. So, does it make sense to extend the tax benefit?
There's no downside. And if it actually is effective, then there's a potential tremendous upside.
Fewer cars on the road, less pollution, and more commuters using mass transit. In Washington, I'm David Gurra for Marketplace.
Now to retail sales. The Commerce Department said today sales jumped almost 1% last month. That marks the fifth straight month of better sales at retailers.
Let's turn to Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us now from St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So break down the numbers for us. Is this good news on the retail side?
Well, it is from the standpoint that this is the fifth month of rising retail sales. It says we're not headed back into recession, and 70% of our economy is really based on consumption. The negative side, though, consumers are very cautious. We've had a 25% decline in credit card accounts. Everybody's using cash and debit cards. Consumers are still reducing debt, increasing savings. They're not looking for any gain in household income, so they want deals on everything or they won't buy. Now, for retailers, this means more traffic volume, but the focus is on bargains, which means lower profit margins.
All right. Now, Julie, we also got earnings this morning from Best Buy, a big, well-known retailer. They were disappointing. The company says demand is dropping. How come Best Buy can't get a piece of this good news in the retail sector?
Well, I think it's really specific to the company because their big focus is on video gaming, TVs, laptops. The problem here is that the prices are falling in TVs because of the recession. There's a huge glut. Nobody repairs anymore. They replace it. And everybody is selling this kind of stuff, even 7-Eleven. So there's huge competition out there. What is selling are the iPods, iPads, i-whatevers, and that's not a big part of Best Buy.
And how many of those do you have right now, Julie? You got all the iPods and iPads?
I've got a Cricket that works really well.
Okay. Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much for your time.
You bet.
Department store JCPenney wants to tap into a big online presence and turn its Facebook fans into shoppers. Now, Penney's is one of the first major retailers to launch a web store inside the social networking site. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Lady Gaga is one of the most popular people on Facebook with more than 10 million fans. Considering that Penney's is a mid-level department store, its fan base isn't too shabby either, with about 1 million. And it wants those fans to do their holiday shopping while they're updating their Facebook status. Penney's has created a web store inside the social network. The Children's Place and Procter & Gamble recently created similar setups. Clay Shirky's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. He says this is a chance for retailers to quantify how much benefit they're getting from Facebook.
We've never really known what it means to be a fan of a brand like Penny, whether that translates into sales or not.
Shirky says the embedded site could also lower the hassle factor of buying stuff. Now, you don't even have to leave Facebook to do a little holiday shopping. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, December 14th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now, the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? A new poll out this week from Bloomberg says that 70% of Americans think big bonuses to Wall Street bankers should be banned. Well, in Ireland, the government has just done exactly that. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Ireland's finance minister has blocked the Allied Irish Bank from paying out $53 million in staff bonuses. He has the power to do this. He's propped up the bank with more than $4 billion in taxpayers' cash, and he says he'll pull the money out if the bank goes ahead with the bonuses. James Riley, deputy head of the main opposition parties, welcomed the government's move. He says that bailing out banks like Allied Irish has triggered painful budget cuts.
Blind people would not be able to afford their guide dog to give them the independence to go to the shop, but bankers could get bonuses for Christmas to cruise the Caribbean. It just is absolutely, utterly unacceptable to the Irish public, and I'm glad it's been stopped.
The bank's board had said it had little choice but to pay the bonuses after a former employee sued. Now it says it's relieved not to be making the payments. The government may pass legislation to ensure that its ban is legal. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Gordon Brown thinks the world can head off another financial crisis by operating off the same page. In his new book, Beyond the Crash, the former British Prime Minister, who also served as the country's Treasury chief, says the world's banks should adopt global standards for capitalization and even regulation. He's with us now to give us his thoughts on the crisis and what can be done to thwart yet another one. Mr. Prime Minister, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
If you had to sum up what it was that started the economic spiral, what was it?
It was mainly a problem in the banking system, and the financial system crashed. It froze, and we've got to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future. I would say that we need a global financial supervision and not simply national financial regulators.
Give me an idea of how crazy things were right after the collapse of Lehman Brothers.
What we had to do was try to get some agreement about what the coordinated response of the world was going to be, because this is not a national crisis. This wasn't simply subprime in America. This was banks freezing up across all parts of the world. But it was touch and go, because basically every country had a different analysis of its own problems. And in Europe, it was felt the problem was American, and therefore it was difficult to persuade the Europeans to act as quickly, because they felt that they were only dealing with the consequences of something that was peculiarly an American problem.
You've said already there should be a certain global financial standard. But if that's the case, doesn't that make critics nervous about a so-called New World Order?
Well, when it came to 2009, people were happy to come together and take the action that was necessary. I'm saying in 2011 that we've got the prospects for Europe and America of a low growth and a high unemployment decade if nothing is done about it. And therefore, it makes sense to come together. It's a sort of new Marshall Plan that would bring the world together.
You call the debate over keeping government stimulus programs one of free market versus government in terms of living standards and morality. And you use the term moral imperative. Do you think the free market lacks morality?
I think the global financial institutions have got to recognize that they need underpinned by balancing off the need for enterprise and competition with being fair, being trustworthy, having integrity and showing responsibility. And, you know, it does come back to people's savings and whether you can get money out of the cash machine and whether you're going to be paid at the end of next week and what your house is worth and when you can be sure about what your job's prospects are. And these are the big issues that a banking failure can raise for millions of ordinary people around the world.
Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And now a tale of festive austerity from Britain. The UK finance minister, Steve, in charge of massive budget cutbacks, said he'd look for cuts big and small. In fact, this holiday season, he tried to buy a cheaper tree for his Treasury department. But that got a lump of coal reception. And we have the story now from London and the BBC's John Bithrie.
Last year, the British Treasury tree cost $1,400, as in typical years, the government paid a private contractor to supply the pine. But this year, Chancellor George Osborne said he was going to trim costs. He's in charge of Britain's biggest spending cut since the 1970s. Risking a Scrooge-like reputation, he came up with the idea to head down to the local hardware store and buy a standard tree for $60. But he claims he met resistance. Treasury officials questioned who would decorate the tree and turn the lights on and off. And the contractor said it wouldn't water a tree that was off contract. British political commentator Quentin Letts calls the whole episode absurd.
What this just shows you, I think, is the way that past governments have been very lax with keeping a control on spending, but also the way that governments get sewn in to expensive contracts by suppliers.
In the end, the contractor supplied a cheaper tree without the trimmings. It was left to the most senior official in the department to get on a chair and put the star on top. No doubt it may have left the British public, already worried about the economic recovery, feeling a little prickly. In London, I'm the BBC's John Bithrie for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, December 14th. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Well, about $50 billion of the $700 billion TARP bank bailout was set aside for mortgage modification. The money was used to bring down people's monthly mortgage costs so they can stay in their homes. Well, the Congressional Oversight Panel has released a report that says those efforts have not been effective. Former Democratic Senator Ted Kaufman chairs the panel, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So in your latest report, the panel estimates that the HAMP program, the mortgage modification program included in the TARP, is only going to prevent a fraction of the foreclosures that were initially estimated by the Treasury Department. Why stick with this program?
The idea was hopefully we'd be able to avoid 3 to 4 million foreclosures. It looks like it's going to be 700,000 to 800,000 foreclosures. But for those 700,000 to 800,000 Americans, that's a very important thing. The other thing is it originally was estimated to be, I think, $50 billion, then down to $30 billion. And it looks like it's only going to be a $4 billion program. So it's not like we spent all the money we thought we would and then come out with a small end. We were going to spend a lot less money and we're going to get a lot less results.
Why do you think it hasn't worked?
A lot of conflict. The servicers, the people who actually handle the loans between the borrower and the lender, these folks did not, they got more money, frankly, foreclosing than they did modifying. So it was to their advantage to foreclose and not to modify.
Senator Kaufman, your panel oversees not just the mortgage modification program, but the entire $700 billion TARP funds.
Right.
Let me just quote from you something that you say in the latest report.
Sure.
A significant portion of the $166.7 billion in TARP funds currently outstanding relates to Treasury's investments in AIG and assistance provided to the automotive industry. Do you think that we are going to get the money back from both of those programs?
Right now, it looks like the AIG program, present estimates are, will cost us $14 billion. And the auto industry, it looks like, will cost about $19 billion. So it's nothing like what we originally said. In addition, in the bank capitalization program, they expect to gain $22 billion. So it looks like the total TARP program, at the present CBO estimates, is about $25 billion in cost.
Quite an amazing turnaround for the TARP. Former Senator Ted Kaufman chairs the congressional panel that oversees the TARP. Thanks so much for speaking with us this morning.
Great talking to you, Jeremy.
You know those guys on the airport tarmac who direct planes with those bright orange wands, Jeremy? You've seen those guys, right?
Of course.
Well, now American Airlines may not need them. The company is using sensors on the terminal wall to glide planes into place. Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold hit the runway for us.
American Airlines is the only major airline to use the devices extensively so far. It's rolling them out at some of the biggest airports across the country, Miami, Dallas, New York, and as recently as this summer, the device went live at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport.
It'll identify the aircraft type, and it will wait until that aircraft type presents itself to this gate.
Pilot John Burton has been with American for 25 years.
When it does, it'll give it guidance for centerline, and then it will allow it to come in to a stop point. And you can see the stop point right there is that yellow T right on the ground.
We're standing on the ramp watching the plane nose in. Burton points out the black box hanging in front of us that looks pretty much like a digital clock. As we walk down the terminal, he brags about how the sensors inside help pilots see exactly where to line up their planes and how they shave 2 minutes off each flight's time on the runway, critical for an airport like O'Hare, notorious for delays.
It's the leading edge. It doesn't get any more up to date than this.
I know that with technology, there's always the chance of failure.
Sean Doyle heads the union in charge of American Airline Marshallers at O'Hare. These workers are responsible for more than just helping to park planes. They also unload luggage and de-ice aircraft. Doyle says under the old system, three people guided one plane to the gate.
With six set of hands on that and all the eyeballs on it, I think it's safer than when we do it with us doing the work personally.
American has not cut any jobs since installing the devices, and Burton, the pilot, says the airline won't. But Doyle isn't so sure. He says he doesn't think his job's in danger until airlines come up with a device that physically unloads bags from the plane. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold for Marketplace.
And while we're talking airlines, Steve, the latest numbers are in on how much the airlines made on all those annoying fees you have to pay, you know, to change your ticket and to check bags.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the total amount so far for the year, almost $4.5 billion. Delta alone collected more than $1 billion. One carrier, though, only made $22 million on fees. Because it doesn't charge a fee to change tickets, and it only charges passengers if they're checking more than two bags. Any guesses as to which carrier that might be?
It's got to be Southwest.
It is Southwest, which, strangely, was still able to post a $200 million profit last quarter.
All right. Golden Globe nominations were announced this morning here in Hollywood, Jeremy. That marks the beginning, of course, of award season.
Yeah.
And Tinseltown is asking locals, of course, to suspend disbelief. But this year, the facts behind some films, even documentaries, have been questioned more than usual. Here's Marketplace's Jennifer Collins.
First, there was Exit Through the Gift Shop, a documentary about the underground art world. Then there was Catfish, another documentary that explored the dubious world of love online.
I mean, she must be pretty awesome, at least from Facebook.
Each film kept moviegoers guessing, and each, though small, brought in over $3 million in the U.S. Paul DeGarabedian is a box office analyst.
I think you're going to see more independent filmmakers making films like this because they're really fun to watch. They're probably really fun to make. And if you can keep your costs down, they're probably profitable.
Jason Squire is the editor of the Movie Business Book.
It really draws more attention to the movie, acts as a marketing tool, and it's great that it helps bring more people into the movie.
Well, most of the time. I'm Still Here, a film about Joaquin Phoenix becoming a hip-hop artist, tanked after he admitted it was contrived. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, there's this California prison inmate who just absolutely hates salami. He detests the stuff. And he was able to get it scrapped from his menu by claiming a unique holiday. Convicted drug dealer Malcolm King requested kosher meals at a jail in Orange County, actually in the city of Orange, right here near Los Angeles. Sheriff's officials reserve those meals for inmates who claim a religious reason.
So what was the holiday that he was talking about?
Festivus.
Seinfeld fan.
You remember. Which was created as an alternative to Christmas and Hanukkah by George Costanza's father on Seinfeld.
A new holiday was born, a Festivus for the rest of us.
And I wonder if he made the prison guards set up that pole. They have to decorate a pole, right?
because that's right. Frank Costanza is scared of tinsel.
Exactly.
I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.